Listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. In this hour, what are the legal, social, and political limitations of free speech? How does the advent of social media and concerns over misinformation have an impact on the exercise of free speech? And how do the new developments of free speech and its limits have an impact on First Amendment protections? But first, perhaps no power within the U.S. Constitution embodies the separations of powers and the diffusion of power quite as much as the presidential veto. While the legislature has the power to pass laws, the executive can reject those laws. But the legislature has the ability to override this rejection and pass the law anyway. But how exactly does the veto work? What's been the history of its use? And what are the trends in the use of the presidential veto? On today's show, we will discuss the current status of the veto, its historic use, and what it means for the diffusion or accumulation of power in the U.S. government. Our guest has written a new encyclopedia of presidential vetoes, John Vile. He's a dean of the Honors College and professor of political science at Middle Tennessee State University. He's the author of The Writing and Ratification of the U.S. Constitution, Practical Virtue in Action, Encyclopedia of Constitutional Amendments, Proposed Amendments, and Amending Issues, 1789 to 2015, and most recently, the Encyclopedia of Presidential Vetoes from Washington through to Biden, History, Subjects, and Procedures. John Vile, thank you very much for joining us today. My first question is, we all learn about the veto when we study the Constitution and, you know, high school and, you know, and all, but let's go back and from that perspective, what is the purpose of the veto and how has it played out historically?
Well, of course, it originated elsewhere. There was a type of veto actually in the Roman Republic. The king exercised, or the monarch in England, Great Britain, exercised a veto. That veto, at least in theory, was an absolute veto. Actually, one of the charges against the king in the Declaration of Independence was that he was vetoing or the British government was vetoing acts of colonial legislation that were essential here. In terms of the American founders, you know, the Constitution was written at a time during which the Articles of Confederation were in existence. They had a very weak national government. You didn't even have an independent executive. And so, you know, one of the key changes was moving from a unicameral Congress to a system of separation of powers with a legislative, executive, and judicial authority. And, you know, the notion was that each would have their own strengths and weaknesses. I think the founders were probably that they thought the most representative branch would be Congress, but because of that, they also thought it might be the most dangerous. And so the veto was a way of, you know, working against particularly precipitous legislation that might get through Congress. But the founders did not want an absolute veto. The president was not going to be a monarch. And so you ended up with a kind of compromise where although the Congress technically exercises a legislative power, the veto almost calls for the president to have at least, well, of course, in addition to introducing legislation, when Congress passes legislation or looks at legislation, they have to be aware that it could be vetoed. And so this hopefully produces some good cooperation between the two branches.
I know that the founding fathers had this sense of an executive and of leadership, of being kind of this, the idea that it was, you know, a civic service, somebody kind of gets called into that service. It wasn't a lifetime of service, and that the president could be seen as somebody who would think more about the entire country, and Congress would be more likely to be swept up in the passions of the day.
Some of that notion may actually come not quite as much from the founders as it does from Jackson, you know, and then later Wilson, that the president was a tribute of the people. I think the framers probably would have thought that Congress overall was probably more representative because it incorporated all the different factions and groups. I've just been reading another book that you might be aware of, and I may be mispronouncing his name, Yuval Levin, American Covenant, in which he talks a lot about the purpose of Congress was to sort of on along the lines of Federalist Number 10, you'd have all these factions and they'd work there among them. But in terms of, the presidency owes a lot to George Washington, not for what he did at the convention, but just for the fact that everybody sort of thought he would be the first president and we'd at least get through 4 or 8 or however many years of him in charge. And he worked very hard, I think, to create sort of what was proper and what was improper. He vetoed, if I remember, only one to three laws. It wasn't very many. But yeah, it was sort of the notion, you're right, overlapping constituencies. Both houses had different constituencies, different sizes, different electoral bases, and the same was true of the president.
And it actually then would seem that with the use of the veto, the idea, at least at the founding, the Constitution, these multiple constituencies, that actually Congress maybe wouldn't pass a lot of laws. There were a lot of hurdles that they had to jump over to pass laws. I mean, is that fair to say that the Constitution is actually written in a way where it's actually pretty hard to pass laws?
Absolutely. There are a lot of sort of veto points other than the veto. I mean, taking the most obvious, the fact that you have a bicameral versus a unicameral Congress, and they both have to pass identical, versions of the bill. And then, even beyond that, even Congress can adopt a law that the president signs or that Congress adopts over his veto that's later declared to be unconstitutional. What I'm not sure that we know completely, because I think it varied from founder to founder, it certainly did among early presidents, was to what degree did they expect it to be vetoes to be done largely on a constitutional basis as opposed to a policy basis? And initially, there was some question, is it proper just to veto a bill because you don't like it or you don't think it would be good, as opposed to, I don't think it's constitutional? And of course, both are very well established by now.
How common was the veto in the early days of the Republic? You mentioned Washington didn't use it that much, but the first set of presidents, was it used pretty often?
Not very frequently. I think it's probably Jackson and his what. There were probably, I should have a chart in front of me and I don't, but maybe 10 to 20. John Tyler, contrary to Harrison, whom he followed, and the accidental president, and ended up sort of vetoing a lot more laws than his party had anticipated. Early in American history, your Whigs generally opposed very strong exercises of the veto, and your Democratic Republicans, again, partly on this Jacksonian notion that the president was a tribute of the people, they were much more likely to exercise it.
Historically, Jackson, you've cited him a couple of times, kind of transformed the presidency, the president is kind of being beholden to the Congress. But Jackson, Jackson changes that. First of all, could you talk a little bit about how he does that? And then what was the impact of that on the use of the veto?
Well, one of the fascinating things about Jackson, I'm still trying to remember how I stumbled into writing an encyclopedia of the veto. Most of what I've done has been on the amending process. But I think one of the things that intrigued me is about 1900, somewhere along in there, there were compilations done of all the presidential vetoes and all the proposed amendments up to that time. And I saw this parallel between them. And then I realized, I've never really looked at presidential vetoes. Well, what's fascinating is you would think that the Constitution would require the Supreme Court to explain its reasoning, but it doesn't. At least as I read it, the court does. Read some good decisions today. But the Constitution explicitly says that when the president vetoes a law, he has to send a message to Congress. And probably the only veto speech that I ever remember, and by speech, usually they were written rather than delivered in orally. But the only one that I could remember prior to starting this encyclopedia was maybe Nixon's reaction to the War Powers Resolution, but it was Andrew Jackson's very long objection to the establishment of the National Bank. And even though John Marshall in McCulloch versus Maryland had said that the bank was constitutional, he said, that's not final. I have a say on this, too. And I believe, by the way, that it may now be a speechwriter. For a long time, they thought Taney had written this decision. I'm not sure which one did, but that's probably one of the more famous vetoes in U.S. history. And, you know, Jackson basically said, you know, Congress is representing all these individual constituencies. I'm the only one representing the entire country.
Now, there's two examples then of kind of famous vetoes, Jackson vetoing the creation of the Bank of the United States and Nixon vetoing the War Powers Act. Both of those were overridden, correct? Or was the bank?
Jackson's was not.
Jackson's was not. Okay.
Now, he was censored for it, which is very interesting. Well, he was censored and then when he got the majority back, they tried to cancel the censure. But most presidential vetoes stick. I don't know the precise percentage, but I'd say 90% or better.
With the War Powers Act, that actually highlights one of the challenges of overriding the veto, because you've got Congress passing this law, Nixon vetoes it, it gets overridden, so it becomes the law. But really, the War Powers Act, the history of it is that presidents tend to ignore it. And so isn't that always a challenge if Congress is overriding a presidential veto, but the president is in charge of executing the law? The president could just ignore the law or execute it in a way that makes it really ineffective, correct?
Well, and particularly in foreign policy, where courts are much less likely to intervene than they would elsewhere. Yeah, it's often a dialogue between the two.
You listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the history and the use of the presidential veto with John Weil of Middle Tennessee State University, who's written a new book called The Encyclopedia of Presidential Vetoes from Washington through to Biden, History, Subjects, and Procedures. Is the veto historically, because you said when we started, it wasn't used all that frequently. Are there periods in American history where we've seen a lot more vetoes?
Yes, two presidents in particular, Grover Cleveland, who's the only president, as you know, who served two non-consecutive terms. If Trump is reelected or elected in 24, he will be the second president to have done that. He vetoed a lot of laws. And then Franklin Roosevelt. Now, in Roosevelt's case, he was in office, you know, for a little over 12 years, so he had more occasion to do so. Since George W. Bush, we've had relatively few vetoes by comparison to the past. And part of it in the last, Biden, I believe, when I've written the book, I think he had done two, and I don't believe he's done any vetoes since then. And they're relatively minor kind of things. I mean, they're not, but part of it is that, you know, the Congress is so divided that it's really not adopting that much legislation. Although, you know, in his favor, he got some big bills passed, you know, shortly after becoming president. And the other thing is, I think this, what they call the veto signaling process has gotten better. Presidents now often, you know, they'll give a statement saying, if you adopt the law with Section A in it, I'm not going to sign it. And if you don't, you know, if you're not sure that you have the power, the number of votes to override it, then you're likely to say, well, you know, if we can get B, C, and D, that'll be, you know, that'll be of some value to us. So a lot of that's going on. And then what's sort of more exciting are the so-called blame game vetoes, where Congress, you know, will adopt the law, sort of forcing the president to veto it. They're not going to worry about overspending because they know the president's going to take care of it, but they hope that they'll get credit from their constituents for having tried to, you know, dole out some money to them that the president canceled.
Yeah, and that actually raises, you know, one practice. Remember during the Reagan administration, there was a lot of talk about reforming the veto, in particular on budgets, where the president can either accept the law is passed or veto it, cannot choose to veto just part of the law. And Reagan had sought that ability to do so. If I remember correctly, it was called the line item veto.
Yes, yes.
So I guess two questions. First of all, could you, you know, describe that? And was that just a proposal? Did it ever get any sort of traction? And then I'll follow that up asking, have there been any other attempts to reform the power of the veto?
Well, to start with, and I probably should have said this earlier, most of the, when when the Constitution was written, most states had very, very weak executives, almost all the power. Often their governors would serve for a single year, have relatively limited terms. New York Constitution had incorporated an executive veto. And as much as we can trace our veto to anywhere, it probably came out of that. But many states have continued this so-called line item veto, particularly in appropriations matter. And there was actually a case that went to the Supreme Court, and naturally I'm not going to remember it. It was out of New York in the Clinton era, in which, and that there were some, you know, scholarly articles in the Wall Street Journal and elsewhere saying the Constitution actually permitted, you know, an item veto, let's give it a try. And the court essentially said no. The only way you could have an item veto would be through constitutional amendment.
And has that been the only attempt to try to reform the veto of power since the Constitution?
No, I mean, there have been many attempts, you know, many proposed amendments to do this throughout history. But that's the only one that I know of where Congress actually adopted a procedure whereby, and it was a little bit more complicated than I'm describing, but the president could veto an individual item and then Congress could overturn or not overturn that particular veto. But, and, you know, there are some, from time to time, you will see somebody who thinks the majority should be increased or decreased for the, you know, overriding a veto and that sort of thing.
Now, you mentioned veto signaling. You get times where Congress is going to pass legislation to force the president, you know, to veto it. But I'd imagine, especially with partisan politics, that the president's party tries to protect him from a veto by trying to ensure that they're not going to vote for a bill that's going to force the president to veto it. Are there any significant examples where the party really breaks with the president? You know, they'll pass legislation and either they knew the president was going to do it, but they really wanted it passed.
Maybe to approach it from a different standpoint, there may be cases where a president revels in vetoing a law. You know, it's a way of mustering their constituency. You know, this Democratic, I mean, depending on what the party is, you know, I'm a Republican, this Democratic Congress is trying to spend too much and I'm going to stop them. Or, you know, I'm a Democrat and this Republican Congress, you know, isn't giving enough. So certainly that happens.
So I would imagine the veto is used a lot more frequently in times of divided government where the
yes.
differentiation of parties.
And if I can sort of add something, one of the things that's happened in terms of the veto that's hard to quantify because it's just changed so much. But up until, I believe it was the 1920s or 30s, there were literally thousands of so-called private bills that were passed. There weren't agencies to take care of pensions for people who had fought in wars or done public service or whatever, or even for you know, building bridges and canals and lighthouses. And so you had a lot of vetoes of these so-called private bills. And what I found most interesting in these were, you know, you'd have a president vetoing a bill for a post office in Podunk, Indiana, or, you know, wherever. And what I find interesting is that often their language is very similar to that of the Supreme Court when it comes to equal protection measures. You know, I'm sure the good people of Podunk deserve a post office, but so does everybody else in the country. And, you know, they only have a population of 200. We have cities here that have 4,000 or more. And so a lot of the language in terms of constitutional principles is fairly similar to what you would find in court decisions.
Do you have any particular favorite vetoes, you know, as you were doing the research that just the story of the veto was particularly fascinating, especially if it's one that maybe we don't know about?
Well, I mean, again, these don't sound particularly important, but Cleveland was one. He vetoed the most bills, and he was certainly, I don't know that I agree with his philosophy, but he was very gutsy. I know this woman is a very deserving woman and that her husband died after whatever war it was, but he didn't die as a result of his injuries. We're not responsible for it. If we started to give money to every widow in the United States, we'd all go bankrupt. And I think that takes a certain courage. Jackson's veto, of course, was very important. James Madison, I think, has a very odd veto. Right at the end of his term, he vetoes a road bill. He had originally opposed the establishment of the National Bank, then had during war after after the or during the War of 1812 decided that maybe it was constitutional after all. And then he sort of, as he goes out, it's but there's really nothing in the Constitution that provides for, other than postal roads to be done, so I'm going to veto that. And Jackson has a very peculiar, he seems to veto improvements in Whig areas, but not so much in Democratic areas. So that sometimes happens as well.
A reminder that a lot of legislation are is complex negotiations and and give and take. And I teach courses on negotiations and I talk about maximizing versus satisficing. You got to give up something to get what you get what you want. And that to limit the veto could really undermine a lot of that process.
We usually oppose special interests and we oppose log rolling, but there have been cases where log rolling and special interest legislation, was the sop that you needed to throw out to get a much bigger objective. And so what works in theory doesn't always work very well in practice, and vice versa.
You mentioned about the political impact of overriding vetoes, the president vetoing and even possibly an override. When I think of overriding a veto, what may be one of the most substantial ones, at least in our lifetime, was when Reagan vetoed the sanctions against South Africa's apartheid regime. And then that veto gets overridden with showing really quite a bit of, quite a bit of bipartisan support. First of all, how unique was that case? And is it fair to say that the process of veto and overriding it really demonstrated Reagan kind of being out of touch, with Congress and signaled to South Africa that the political climate had really changed in the United States and the president was going to protect you any longer?
Well, it's not a veto, but frankly, we've had something very similar within the last 6 months, or 8 months, I guess it is. Zelensky saying, it's absolutely urgent that we get far, you get Israel, Taiwan, and China, and Ukraine all sort of stuck, and the president's out there saying we're behind you 100%, and Congress is saying, well, we're not so sure, not so fast. So I think that overriding a veto in an area of foreign policy is probably among the diciest or most controversial vetoes that you can get, because, and again, the Constitution, the Congress has the power to declare war and it has the power to appropriate war, but the president is commander in chief and he's the head of state. And I think certainly it would be much more embarrassing to have a veto over something like aid to South Africa or Ukraine or whatever else. I was surprised today. Biden was in, who's overseas, I believe it was in Italy, and was saying, we're going to sign a 10-year agreement with Ukraine. Well, if Trump were to be reelected president, I'm not sure that he would continue that.
And that's always the challenge between legislation and executive action is that
Yes.
any form of executive action can just be overturned by a different executive, which makes sense there. It's kind of my last question. You decided to write an encyclopedia, and you've written a couple of different encyclopedias. First of all, how different is the process of writing an encyclopedia versus just a historical narrative? And what do you see as the value of writing it as an encyclopedia rather than, as I said, a historical narrative on vetoes?
Part of it, I think, comes from my job. As a dean, I get interrupted constantly. My door is always open. And I find it harder sometimes to work. Now, a chapter I don't have too much trouble with, but to start beginning to end in a book, as opposed to, putting A to Z and then filling in individual ones, I find I can do that easier. It's easier to assemble 500 different parts or however many than it is to do one cohesive narrative with the kind of schedule that I have. I've done several of these, as you pointed out, and once you do them, you sort of look for common things to do, and you realize you need a little bibliography for each entry. You need to remember cross references, and one of the things that I've never heard discussed for people that want to write I had contributed or contributed in my lifetime to a lot of encyclopedias where somebody asked me to write five entries or two chapters or whatever. But I find one advantage of doing an entire encyclopedia by yourself is if I were writing a single essay and I came across something novel that the editor didn't know about it, I don't know that I'd pass it on to him. Whereas here, I'll be researching something for Jackson and say, hey, I think I saw that with Jimmy Carter, or I saw that with the subsequent president, and it helps me to integrate it a little bit better. I often, you know, use encyclopedias when I'm doing my own work. You may know I contribute to Middle Tennessee State University, where I work, has an online First Amendment encyclopedia. It actually grew out of a two-volume work that I co-edited, and we subsequently put it online. And it's amazing. We get like 5 million hits a year on this one encyclopedia, and almost every week or two, you know, we come up with some new entries and needed updates. That's the downside of it.
I think in the age of Wikipedia, where a lot of this gets crowdsourced, the value of having an expert maintaining the encyclopedia, whether it's a series of authors, you know, with a very talented editor, or somebody, you know, like you writing this encyclopedia yourself, is a reminder that, though I'm not going to be a hypocrite, I use Wikipedia sometimes.
I think all of us do. It's a great sort of secret.
Right.
Although, if you're like me, I use it, but I almost always verify it. If I cannot verify it, then it doesn't go in. But for, you know, dates and court names and that kind of thing, it's an excellent resource.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. It's a great first look. It should never be your last look. But right. What could be a great last look is, of course, this encyclopedia. This is the Encyclopedia of Presidential Vetoes, from Washington through to Biden, History, Subjects, and Procedures. The author is John Vial. He's the Dean of the Honors College and a professor of political science at Middle Tennessee State University. He's the author of The Writing and Ratification of the U.S. Constitution, Practical Virtue in Action, an Encyclopedia of Constitutional Amendments, Proposed Amendments, and Amending Issues, 1789 and 2015, alongside this Encyclopedia of Presidential Vetoes. John Vial, thank you very much for joining us and, you know, sharing your expertise, enlightening us and reminding us of this practice that we all learn in high school. There's something called a veto, and a reminder of just how important it actually is. Thank you.
Thank you. Were you subject to how a bill becomes law?
Oh, of course. And in fact,
yes.
in fact, the Saturday morning show, the song automatically goes in my head. I have to admit that I miss those little pieces of civic engagement, civic education on Saturday mornings. And we'll state for the record, with so much misinformation about how the government works, we kind of need them back.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. In any case, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
When we come back, how does the advent of social media and concerns over misinformation have an impact on the exercise of free speech? And how do the new developments of free speech and its limits have an impact on the First Amendment protections? We look at the legal, social, and political limitations of free speech.
Please stay tuned.
Welcome back to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker.
The First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution guarantees a right to the freedom of speech. But how absolute is this freedom? How does it interact with other freedoms outlined in the Constitution, most notably the interaction between the First and the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms? What is the impact of 21st century speech, such as the role that social media plays, other different forms of expression and understanding, of the First Amendment protections for free speech? And how is our understanding of free speech challenged by recent campaigns to ban books, to limit the teaching of history and concerns about the so-called critical race theory, or CRT, and the impact of cancel culture? Dennis Barron has written a new book on free speech, language, political expression, and legal limitations. The book is called You Can't Always Say What You Want, The Paradox of Free Speech. Dennis Barron is Emeritus Professor of English at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He's a frequent commentator on language issues in the national media and has written a number of popular books, including What's Your Pronoun? Professor Barron, Dennis, thank you very much for joining us. My first question, we know we have a free speech, but there's limits to those free speech. Exactly how expansive is our right to free speech?
Our right to free speech is both expansive and limited. Okay, so there's a general confusion that a lot of people have. First Amendment says Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. But as we probably know, Congress actually does make some laws banning obscene speech or threats or defamation. It's against the law. Lying under oath, never a good idea. So it's the right is framed as a legal absolute, but in terms of practice, it's contingent. There are some forms of speech that are not protected, that are just assumed not to be covered by the First Amendment. So let's add to that, you raise the issue of social media, free speech on social media. Now that's private speech. That has nothing to do really with government control. Doesn't come under the auspices of any federal agency, not the Federal Communication Commission, which controls over-the-air radio and TV broadcasting, for example. So that's private speech, and that's subject to whatever rules and regulations the owner of the platform decides to impose on users. And they can be applied consistently, or they can be applied haphazardly. A lot of people point out that their social media accounts are moderated disproportionately. Very well-known speakers, famous speakers, politicians don't get the same kinds of controls placed on their speech as ordinary folks who may have a fairly small following, but are told, you violated our community terms of service, you are suspended for 3 days, or whatever. So there's that. So speech is both a legal and a social phenomenon. And while the law can impose certain kinds of restrictions on speech, it generally lets you say what you want pretty much when you want. But whatever social group you're in, whether it's your boss or your school or your family or your friends or a social media platform or some club you belong to, they're free to establish both very clear guidelines on speech behavior and sometimes very imprecise, inexplicit guidelines. There's pressure. We all feel that pressure. We can say whatever we want as long as we're willing to face the consequences of what we say.
You mentioned social media, so I guess we can dig into this just a little bit. Officially, it's the media platform, whether it's Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, et cetera, TikTok, that are making the decisions whether or not certain statements, certain claims meet community standards. But in particular, this has really seemingly heightened by a desire to get rid of clear misinformation, in particular with the pandemic, you know, has highlighted this. And the government certainly seems at different times to suggest they might take a bigger role at trying to assert what is not allowed, maybe take away some protections that these platforms currently have if they don't open up or shut down certain types of speech.
The government has traditionally played the role of a kind of external monitor for communication, and sometimes by threatening to impose restrictions. Okay, we're good. You're not going to clean up your act. We're going to pass a law that makes you clean up your act. This happened in the early days of film. Okay, when movies come on the scene, and this is a kind of curiosity, all kinds of censorship boards spring up in cities and states to regulate what you can show on the screen. Too much skin, elements of plot that don't meet public approval, a film of Carmen, the opera Carmen, which takes place in a cigarette factory, was censored in some states because it was not a good idea to portray smoking. It was deemed offensive in the early 1900s. And in fact, there was a Supreme Court case around 1915, which said that movies don't merit First Amendment protection because they're not speech, they're entertainment. Okay, this was reversed in the 1960s. But, you know, for a long time, movies were considered beyond the Constitution's protection. So what happens is the government says at various points, things have gone too far with the movies. There's too many things that children shouldn't be allowed to see, that the lower classes wouldn't appreciate, that's encouraging crime, too many shoot 'em ups, too many murders, too many robberies, people are smoking, they're having oh my God, they're having sex off screen, but they're having sex, they're hinting at it. The government is going to take a stand. And so to prevent the government from enacting any laws, the movie industry set up its own regulation system. Same thing happens with video games, with CDs in closer to the present, where the industry says, okay, we're going to have a rating system. This is for general consumption. This is not for kids. This is for, you know, over 17s. We're going to give this guidance to forestall the government from imposing regulations on us. Okay. And so this is what the social media platforms are trying to do. We're going to have these terms of service, user agreements that you have to click okay or you can't get on the platform. And they're going to state all kinds of stuff. And of course, nobody reads them. They're so long. They're full of legalese. They're composed by lawyers for lawyers. They're not for us to read. They're for us to click OK. And if we do that, the government will leave us alone. And in fact, the way that the current federal law covering social media is framed is that they can do whatever they want, but we encourage them to patrol and regulate content to avoid, they don't specify, but to avoid unseemly content. Things not suitable for children, for example, or lies, disinformation, hate speech, defamation, all kinds of things that technically they could allow, but we discourage them from doing it. We encourage them to clean it up.
Right.
And so the
Yeah,
Go ahead.
and on that, you highlighted something I thought was particularly fascinating. When you talk about the movie industry, you had a decentralized system of censorship, if you will, pressures on theaters from airing certain films. Then the industry itself moves to try to centralize that, you know, the infamous Hays Code for that. But then
Right.
when the Hays Code became unpopular, now the framing is very much there's a difference in free speech with adults and with children. The nature of the rating system, the warning labels on video games, and also books, you know, et cetera. And I think about like what's the way the issues get framed about what's being taught in the classroom versus
Right.
what gets published. So I guess part of this is how much is the protection of children being used as a tool to generally chill free speech, and how much is a pretty legitimate question about, I mean, there is certain speech we should be much more comfortable around adults than we are around children.
Right. I mean, it's a legitimate concern. Forget about government regulation. Families try to regulate, you know, what kinds of things the kids say, you know, penalizing children for swearing, let's say, or sometimes for, you know, using grammatical forms that the parents disapprove of. We don't want you to sound like that. We want you to sound like this. And so it doesn't work very well because kids grow up and they still swear. So that language policing is always there, and it seems to be singularly ineffective, doesn't do its job, which leads us to question whether it needs to do that job, or are we just going through the motions? You know, is it good enough that the kid doesn't swear in front of the grandparents? What happens when the grandparents swear in front of the kid? You know, something is always going to go wrong. You know, and the system is always going to be imperfect. It's going to be continually adjusting to changing circumstances. And I mean, flexibility is really what you want to have in these kinds of situations, rather than a series of hard and fast rules saying, for example, like Florida, you can't say this in the classroom. You can't say right. that. Sarah Sanders bans the use of Latinx by mm-hmm. government employees on her first day as governor of Arkansas. These sorts of, I mean, it generates a lot of publicity. It's not effective. Doesn't make a difference. And it's a pretext for a kind of signaling, you know, this we believe in free speech, so you're not allowed to say this, which go figure, as we say.
One of the big points was that on the grounds of protecting children, you're signaling certain types of, you know, certain historians. I think about the discourse over critical race theory. It's really about a way in which the government is signaling certain historians and trying to discredit them as legitimate historians by labeling that. And then the book banning campaigns, et cetera, they're all directed ostensibly at children. But it seems like they have a bigger fish to fry about trying to.
Right. The audience is not. We're not protecting children from this stuff. We're protecting grown-ups. Mm-hmm. And we are taking protections away from teachers and librarians who are professionally charged with knowing what's appropriate and sifting through the material and determining, you know, what's good for this age group, for this interest group, or what makes a book worth reading, worth keeping in our collections, worth talking about in the classroom, and what books should we just sort of ignore and you know, get on with what's important in education. And it's taking that decision away from the people who are professionally qualified to do that, and put in the hands of people who probably don't even read these books, but just get wind of, oh, this ought to be banned. This ought to be banned. This is, you know, this is grooming. This is harmful. This is a secret plot to get at the children and sort of eviscerate society that way.
Yeah, absolutely. And you listen to
it's,
scholars.
It's not new. Not new. Not new. Yeah. But it's a new version of an old story.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle. ScholarCircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're talking about free speech and its limits and its effects with the author of a new book called You Can't Always Say What You Want, The Paradox of Free Speech. That author is Dennis Barron of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Now, one aspect of your book I found particularly fascinating is the way in which freedoms intersect, interplay, and one could certainly have an impact on another, and specifically how the Second Amendment could potentially chill the First Amendment. Could you explain, first of all, what was the motivation in contrasting those two, and what is the impact the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms, has on the right to free speech?
So the first two amendments, First Amendment covers speech, it covers religion, covers freedom to assembly and petition the government. I'm really just looking at the free speech aspects of it, not the religion aspects of it. I'm no expert in that sort of thing, so I try to just stay in my lane, to use a phrase I try to avoid. The Second Amendment is about the right to bear arms, and since 2008, the Supreme Court has defined it as protecting an individual right to bear arms for any legal purpose. And each constitutional right, each part of the Constitution, is considered by scholars as being equal in importance to every other part of the Constitution. So the First Amendment and the Second Amendment are equal in their force, in their intention, in their effect. But what happens is, okay, if you have a First Amendment right to speak and a Second Amendment right to carry a gun to, let's say, a political protest, to ostensibly support your rights to speak. And what got my interest was the incident in Charlottesville a few years ago, where the white supremacists rallied in Charlottesville, in Virginia, to ostensibly protect the right to free speech. That was their slogan. You know, this is a free speech rally. And Virginia, being an open carry state, they brought their guns to town. And what you see happening on the ground, because the law enforcement was not either willing or able to separate the two sides, the protesters who were the neo-Nazis and the white supremacists and their opponents who objected to their philosophy, the law enforcement did not keep them apart. Violence erupted, and because the neo-Nazis and the white supremacists, quite a few of them were armed. They had guns, they had other kinds of weapons, they had pepper sprays and batons and whatnot. What you see happening is when the First and Second Amendments clash, the people with the guns tend to shut up to people with just the words. So I'm not the only person who is noticed this. Lots of people have been commenting on it, and it's very problematic in terms of permitting firearms in potentially contentious locations, not just political rallies, but bars, sporting events, other sorts of places where historically they have often been banned, but more and more as the courts increase the right to bear arms in public, you're going to have more and more situations where people are just going to, instead of taking to their words, they're going to take to their guns and silence everybody else.
One of the main themes here that we have free speech, whether we can exercise that free speech in part is dependent on consequences. And if those who are challenging you are armed, there's a certain consequence in horrific cases. Martin Luther King gets assassinated for his free speech and for his activism. And of course, in Charlottesville, one of the activists, Heather Heyer, was killed, though not by a gun, by a car.
Right.
But then broadly, that's actually been one of the great misunderstandings about free speech. The free speech, you know, in this case, these consequences are completely unwarranted. But in other cases, the fact that there are consequences to your free speech, I suppose it's a limit to that speech. But, you know, I think, for example, people who will say things, controversial things, and then find themselves, the term these days is canceled, you know, as a result of that. Is cancel culture a violation of free speech?
Depends on how you look at it. Actually, if you think about it, it's two groups of speakers disagreeing over a particular issue. And does the audience have a right to make so much noise that the speaker can't get their message across? That's something you have to think about. Should an invitation to speak be withdrawn if it looks like there's going to be trouble, if it looks like there's going to be protests? So this is what we call the heckler's veto. And there's legal precedents that say that the heckler's veto is not permitted, that you're not allowed to stop a speaker from speaking because you're afraid the crowd will break out in violence against that speaker, or the speaker will drum up a violent reaction from the crowd. The argument is that You know, if you're afraid there's going to be a violent reaction, have law enforcement present to quell any disturbance that arises. But in real life situations, this doesn't always happen. The violence takes place despite the presence of law enforcement, sometimes apparently with the encouragement of it. And so it's a very tricky thing. But it's a convenient calling card for the conservatives to say, oh, it's cancel culture. You know, the left doesn't want to hear anybody who disagrees with them. Well, that's not exactly true. Okay. And while both extremes of the political spectrum do engage in policing speech, it's the conservative side, the extreme right-wing side, that seems at the present moment to be the most highly organized, the most well-funded, has the biggest platforms, gets the most ink in the media, whereas attempts on the left to police speech to make people be more inclusive, for example, tend to be the very definition of disorganized and haphazard and inconsistent and vary significantly from place to place and in terms of how effective they are. So, and they're not well funded at all. Okay, there's no, you know, huge, deep pocketed conservative backers throwing money at stuff on the left. It's just whatever you can get. So yeah, the both sidesism argument just does not work for me, because it's the right that's controlling everything and at the same time claiming, oh, my free speech is being violated, to millions and millions of followers.
Now, one area that you do highlight, and this is going to be so the last topic, we got about 3-4 minutes left, but where clearly there is a limitation for speech has been the ability to use civil courts to challenge challenge speech. So you can say what you want, but if you libel or slander somebody, you could face consequences, et cetera. Is civil litigation really stamp down free speech? Because, I mean, that's a tactic that's been used by critics of free speech pretty regularly.
Not in the U.S. It doesn't work that well in the U.S., okay? So attempts to sue someone for defamation, basically, to be successful, you have to prove that the person allegedly defaming you knew that what they were saying was a lie, was false, knew, and that they intended to harm you by doing it. And that's very difficult to prove in court. Typically, the defense is, it was an innocent mistake. We corrected it in the next edition, if it's in the news, for example. Didn't intend any harm, did not know it wasn't true. And if it's a public figure who's being defamed in the U.S., the legal, I mean, this isn't legal doctrine, but the feeling tends to be, if you're a public figure, then there's more latitude for criticizing you. You've put yourself out there, and so, you know, you got to take your medicine. You got to take the good along with the bad along with the good. In England, it's much easier to prove defamation. And you really, really are on what you call the back foot in England. If you've said something or published something and someone says you've defamed me, it's up to you to prove that you haven't. And it's much easier to win a defamation case in Britain than it is in the U.S. So there's a distinction there. But if we're talking about the U.S., that route doesn't work very well. The slap lawsuits, selective litigation against public participation, don't work well.
And we've been discussing the ongoing, so what is the status of free speech? What are the limitations to free speech? What are the consequences? What are the ways in which speech can be chilled? We've been discussing this new book, You Can't Always Say What You Want, The Paradox of Free Speech. The author is Dennis Barron. He is the Emeritus Professor of English at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. It's a fascinating read. I encourage you to pick it up. So thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Doug.
I'd like to give a special thanks to the Scholar Circle team, Maria Armudian, host and anchor, Ankine Agassian, managing producer, Sud Dongri, webmaster and production assistant. All Scholar Circle shows are archived on scholarcircle.org. You can find our podcast on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. On behalf of the Scholar Circle team, I am Doug Becker. Thank you for listening.
We will close with Robinson Jeffers' poem, Shine, Perishing Republic.
Shine, perishing republic. While this America settles in the mold of its vulgarity, heavily thickening to empire, and protest, only a bubble in the molten mass pops and sighs out, and the mass hardens. I, sadly smiling, remember that the flower fades to make fruit. The fruit rots to make earth, out of the mother, and through the spring exultances, ripeness and decadence, and home to the mother. You making haste, haste on decay, not blameworthy. Life is good. Be it stubbornly long or suddenly immortal splendor, meteors are not needed less than mountains. Shine, perishing republic. But for my children, I would have them keep their distance from the thickening center. Corruption never has been compulsory. When the cities lie at the monster's feet, there are left the mountains. And boys, be in nothing so moderate as in love of man, a clever servant, insufferable master. There is the trap that catches noblest spirits, that caught, they say, God when he walked on earth.